for Human Rights. Thank you. Fra Hughes, pleasure. Journalist, author, and activist there from Belfast. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vitavwe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa huwal القيوم لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات وما من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات والأرض من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه يعلم ما بين أيديهم وما خلفهم ولا يحيطون بشيء من علمه إلا بما شاء وسع
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not, and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Tensions on the Korean Peninsula reaching a dangerous level, with South Korea and the U.S. kicking off a new round of maritime war games. The Kremlin warning that Ukraine's president's statements about preventive nuclear strikes on Russia are a direct call to start a world war. Also ahead, the U.S. says it's weighing its options in response to Saudi Arabia agreeing to massive OPEC plus oil production cuts. Thank you for joining us. Now, top story this hour, South Korea and the U.S. are conducting joint maritime drills as tensions simmer with North Korea over its ballistic missile tests. Seoul says the drills take place in waters off South Korea's east coast on Friday and Saturday. It says the war games aim to strengthen readiness to any provocations by North Korea. The USS Ronald Reagan Carrier Strike Group is taking part in the drills. It also participated in trilateral exercises with warships from Japan and South Korea on Tuesday. That's when North Korea launched a ballistic missile that overflew part of Japan. The North on Thursday launched two more ballistic missiles and flew warplanes near the border with the South. Pyongyang has condemned Washington for repositioning its aircraft carrier near the Korean Peninsula, saying it threatens stability there. The North says its launches are a countermeasure to the joint drills by the South and the U.S. Jennifer Chang is our correspondent in the South Korean capital, Seoul, with the latest. Jennifer, what more can you tell us? And also, if you can touch on the people's reactions, we have seen massive protests in the past in South Korea against these joint war games.
Yes. Right now, many South Koreans are saying that there really is no need to be showing such military force here. The U.S. and South Korea have been deploying the USS Ronald Reagan aircraft carrier to give a big show of force to the North over its missile tests. But many experts say that the North is going to do these missile tests anyway. Regardless of whether the U.S. sends strategic assets like the Reagan aircraft carrier here to the Korean Peninsula, because the North wants to perfect its nuclear and missile programs, and it wants to then try to get the U.S. to negotiate with it as a nuclear power so that it can win sanctions relief and security guarantees from the U.S. And many Koreans feel here in South Korea that perhaps things are getting too tense here on the Korean Peninsula, that there's too much friction between the two Koreas as a result of so many military drills taking place between the U.S. and South Korea, and so many shows of force by the U.S., South Korea, and Japan. Now, the latest show of force is another drill between U.S. and South Korea involving the USS Ronald Reagan, and that follows on the heels of yesterday's drill between the U.S., South Korea, and Japan involving the USS Ronald Reagan, where the three allies practiced tracking North Korean ballistic missiles and intercepting them. And of course, this was in response to North Korea's big missile test on Tuesday, where it fired an IRBM over Japan for the first time since 2017. So this was unplanned, and the exercise that is going to take place between the U.S. and South Korea in the East Sea involving the USS Ronald Reagan is also unplanned. Things are escalating too quickly in the minds of many South Koreans. There are too many unplanned things going on. And there is a concern that maybe some kind of accidental skirmish or conflict might break out here on the Korean Peninsula if something is not done to tamp down these tensions. And the UN Security Council, which in the past was unanimous in sanctioning North Korea over its ballistic missile tests, is now divided, with China and Russia saying the U.S. is to blame for the North Korean ballistic missile tests, that these sanctions are a dead end. That's what Russia said. And China said that it feels the UN Security Council should focus on being constructive rather than passing sanctions against North Korea over its ballistic missile tests. Now, the latest tension involves warplanes being sent by North Korea, 12 warplanes in all, with 8 fighter jets and 4 bombers. They were sent at about 2 p.m. yesterday, Thursday, following the 2 missiles that were fired, the SRBM, short-range ballistic missiles that were fired by North Korea in the morning. And this took place for about an hour near the inter-Korean border. North of that border, the North Korean warplanes flew in formation and conducted a bombing drill, and that caused 30 South Korean fighter jets to be scrambled over there to the inter-Korean border on the southern side. So tensions were unusually high yesterday. This is very rare for North Korean warplanes to be sent like that to do a bombing drill near the inner Korean border. And the U.S. is now trying to figure out how it is going to deal with this type of situation. Right. It is consulting with its allies, the U.S. and Japan. And the U.S., many experts say, has to do something to reduce tensions here on the Korean Peninsula.
Amazing how wherever there is a U.S. military presence in the world, there is also insecurity in that part of the world. Jennifer, thank you very much indeed for that. Jennifer Chang there, our correspondent, joining us from the South Korean capital, Seoul. Moving on, Russia has criticized the Ukrainian president for calling on the Western military alliance NATO to launch preventive strikes on Moscow. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said such statements are, quote, nothing other than an appeal to start yet another world war with unpredictable, monstrous consequences. The reaction came after Volodymyr Zelensky said he believed the strikes were necessary to prevent any use of nuclear weapons by Russia. Russia's foreign ministry has also accused Zelensky of trying to provoke a nuclear war. This as Moscow has time and again stated that it is not considering a nuclear strike on Ukraine, but Russia had warned that it will use any means necessary to protect its borders, people, and sovereignty. Meanwhile, the U.S. president says the world is risking a, quote, nuclear Armageddon for the first time since the Cold War. Joe Biden made the unusually strong comments at a Democratic Party event in New York. He pointed to the recent nuclear threats by Moscow and said Vladimir Putin was not joking about a potential use of tactical nuclear and biological weapons. He also added that Washington was trying to find what he called Putin's off-ramp. Gilbert Doctorow is an independent international affairs analyst and joins us now live from Brussels. Gilbert, welcome. How much should the world be concerned about NATO taking Zelensky's call for preventive strikes on Russia seriously? Is there the possibility of the war entering a new phase with a direct NATO involvement?
I don't think that's in the cards. If NATO wanted to go head-to-head against Russia, they would have accepted eagerly Zelensky's call for immediate accession into NATO, which he delivered last week, but which was turned down hours later by Jens Stoltenberg, who said that accession procedures are well established and take a good deal of time, meaning that this Kiev regime will never enter NATO. However, let's take Zelensky's remarks as being more serious than the rantings of a drug addict, which he is. The statements that Zelensky makes are appeals to the United States, to the warmongering senators and others on Capitol Hill, who are considerable in numbers. And let's remember that the United States, since the very start of the nuclear age, at the end of the 40s, has had plans in its drawers to make a nuclear strike against then the Soviet Union. The hope was that they would demilitarize the Soviet Union by such strikes. These plans never went away. They were brought to the public's attention in the most effective way by the film Dr. Strangelove in 1964, in which the calculus of nuclear deterrence were there for all of us to see, with a deranged general explaining to the president in this film that, yes, we can get away with it, that we will have to take a small haircut, meaning 15 or 20 million American lives lost in a Russian or Soviet then counterstrike, but it was worth doing. So these plans to which Zelensky was making appeal have never gone away. And at the same time, I'd like to call attention to the fake news and the fake interpretation which none other than the President of the United States, Joe Biden, made yesterday in the sentences which you have just aired. Biden said that Russia was considering using tactical nuclear weapons and chemical weapons in the campaign against Ukraine. That is fabricated in the Pentagon and in the State Department. It is not coming from Russia. The Russian plans for use of nuclear weapons, if it comes to that, are in a situation where its existence is threatened, such as by a first strike that Mr. Zelensky was advocating. And the objective of such strikes would not be Ukraine. It would likely not be in first order Europe. It would be Washington, D.C.
Okay, so just to clarify, Gilbert, because we're hearing a lot of rhetoric about the use of nukes from all sides. Zelensky is pushing NATO for preventive strikes on Russia. Putin has talked about some NATO representatives threatening to use nukes. He has also said Russia is not bluffing about using nukes if its territorial integrity is at risk. How serious is the risk of nuclear arms being used in this war?
It is very unlikely to improbable. It could only be sparked by NATO and American actions. Such actions were described explicitly by President Putin, and that would be, in the first order, a strike against Russia, such as Zelensky is advocating, that would bring a nuclear riposte from Russia. However, it is most unlikely to improbable that NATO and the United States would ever implement what Mr. Zelensky is calling for, because they know it's suicide. And they will not do Mr. Zelensky the favor of dying with him.
And then, Gilbert, just as we've got you on the line, Zelensky has also said there will be no talks with Russia as long as Putin is president. What do you read into this, and what's his message here?
It's an invitation to the decapitation of the military and civilian leadership in Ukraine. Mr. Putin has delivered some very harsh words, very tough language, a week ago when he spoke before signing the papers of affiliation, the papers of integration of the four Ukrainian provinces, oblasts, into the Russian Federation. That was tough talk. It is now that the documents have all been signed, now that the paperwork is done and these four regions are legal de jure, part of the Russian Federation to be defended by Russia by all means, we have to wait and see where will be the tough deeds. The first of those tough deeds, if Mr. Putin wants to avert any risk of a nuclear escalation, is to remove the regime in Kiev.
Of course, the world has seen a nuclear Armageddon, and it was the United States who committed it. Dr. O, thank you very much indeed for your time. Gilbert is an independent international affairs analyst joining us from the Belgian capital, Brussels. Moving on, Iran's foreign minister has once again rejected allegations that it provided Russia with weapons for the ongoing war with Ukraine. Hossein Emi Abdullahian says Tehran has not and will not provide any sort of arms to Russia to be used in the war. He made the remarks in a phone call with his Finnish counterpart, Pekka Haavisto. Emi Abdullahian said his country wants that Russia and Ukraine resolve their conflict through political means. He underlined that any kind of military aid to the warring sides would only delay in restoring peace. The Ukrainian military has recently accused Russia of using Iranian-made drones in the Mykolaiv region. Kiev also announced downgrading diplomatic relations with Iran, citing a similar pretext. Tehran expressed regrets over the decision and advised Ukraine to avoid being influenced by third parties seeking to destroy the two countries' relations. Delegations from the Caspian littoral states have gathered in the Russian capital to participate in the second Caspian Economic Forum. The event has become the largest platform in the post-pandemic period to discuss topics including cooperation among member states. Iran's foreign minister has criticized the West for its double standards on human rights, especially with regard to women's rights. Hossein Emi Abdullahian made the remarks in a phone call with his Irish counterpart, Simon Coveney. Emi Abdullahian was reacting to interventionist remarks by some Western countries following recent riots in Iran over the death of a young woman after being taken by police. The top Iranian diplomat said Iranians have the constitutional right to hold peaceful protests. He, however, stressed that some rioters were directed from overseas and were incited by foreign media outlets. He said the rioters vandalized public property and attacked people as well as the police with firearms and cold weapons. Emi Abdullahian noted that rioters will be brought to justice. The Iranian minister also highlighted the internet restrictions during the January 2021 protests in America, which erupted over the U.S. presidential election outcome. He said even the social media accounts of then-American president were shut down. That brings an end to World Bulletin for this hour.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive. And make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Prophet Muhammad and Lady Khadija, the made for each other pair. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam, friends, and congratulations to you on an auspicious day. Today, the 10th of Rabiul Awwal, is that blessed day in history when Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and the chaste monotheistic lady Hazrat Khadija bint Khubaylid, peace upon her, were joined together in marriage to lay the blessed foundation of the Immaculate Ahlal Bayt. Please stay with us for a special feature on the wedding of the Prophet, who, during 25 years of marital bliss, never took another spouse as long as Ummul Mu'minin, or the mother of all true believers, Hazrat Khadija, peace upon her, was alive. In the Prophet of Allah, there is certainly for you an excellent exemplar. For those who look forward to Allah and the last day and remember Allah greatly. This is what God Almighty says in the Noble Quran regarding His best of creation, who was granted the universal mission of Islam for the salvation of mankind and perfection of all humanitarian values, including a healthy family life that revolves around a loyal wife and morally sound offspring. God Almighty thus blessed His greatest prophet with the most excellent lady of His times, Hazrat Khadija, peace upon her, as His sole companion in the prime of His manhood to share 25 years of marital bliss, during which the husband never took another spouse. The sweet, eternally surviving fruit of this auspicious union that was solemnized in Mecca on 10th of Rabiul Awwal in the year 25 Amul Fil, corresponding to 595 AD, was the immaculate daughter Hazrat Fatimatu Zahra, peace upon her, the noblest ever lady of all times, whose marriage to the infallible Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib gave the Prophet such impeccable grandchildren as sons Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, and daughters Hazrat Zainab and Hazrat Umm Kulthum, peace upon them. Although out of social necessity and in order to break the taboos of Jahiliyat, the middle-aged widower Prophet had to marry in the last 10 years of his life 9 other wives who were never equal to the First Lady of Islam, the eternity of his progeny was ensured through Hazrat Khadija, peace upon her, or more precisely through their radiant daughter Hazrat Fatima, peace upon her, addressed with the honorific title of Sadat, plural of Sayyid. They are respected till this day throughout the world, while the most peerless amongst them, such as the infallible Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, have ensured the glory of Islam in every age through their self-sacrificing efforts, the climax being the immortal epic of Karbala. Moreover, the Redeemer of mankind, the awaited Imam Mahdi, peace upon him, who will reappear in the end times to cleanse the earth from corruption and oppression by establishing the global government of peace, prosperity and justice, is the direct descendant of Prophet Muhammad and the matchless Khadija, peace upon them, and their progeny. These undeniable facts make celebration of the auspicious anniversary of the Prophet's marriage all the more important, since it was his only formal wedding and was conducted with unrivaled splendor, as his uncle and guardian, Hazrat Abu Talib, peace upon him, arranged a 3-day feast for the guest, while the wealthy bride fed the whole populace of Mecca for over a month in order to make the events unforgettable forever. Our sincere salutations to Khadijat al-Kubra, peace upon her, the daughter of Khuwaylib ibn Asad and Fatima bint Ziyada, a third cousin of the Prophet, a family which, like the Bani Hashim, had safeguarded the monotheist traditions of Prophet Abraham, the iconoclast, in those dark days of ignorance of the pagan Arabs. The 25-year-old Malikat al-Arab, or the richest lady of Arabia, who had never married any person before and had spurned all suitors as unworthy, was indeed divinely inspired when she chose the future prophet as her husband, and being impressed by his honesty and moral integrity as manager of her trade caravans, even though he was poor, having long lost his parents, Abdullah ibn Abdul Muttalib and Amine bint Wahab. Acclaimed as Tahire, or the chaste, for remaining single so far, the nikah, or nuptials, were solemnized by none other than that primordial Muslim, Abu Talib, peace upon him, who along with his wife Fatima bint Asad, peace upon her, had brought up his orphaned nephew as his own son. No wonder God Almighty says in Ayah 8 of Surah Dhuha, "Did he not find you needy and enrich you?" These divine words are not a reminder of some forgotten favor to his messenger, but is a clear reference to the change of fortune in the life of the 25-year-old scion of the noble Hashemite clan. In other words, it was a marriage made in heaven. Anyone in doubt about belief in the oneness of Allah, the God of Abraham, by Khadija, peace upon her, by her family, by her cousin, Waraq ibn Nawfal, and by Abu Talib, are advised to ponder on the sermon delivered by the uncle while solemnizing the nuptials of his nephew, as recorded by the famous Sunni scholar Ibn Hisham in Siratun Nabawiyah. All praise is due to Allah, who has made us the progeny of Abraham, the seed of Ishmael, the descendants of Maud, the substance of Mudur, and who made us the custodians of his house and the servants of its sacred precincts. He also gave us authority over the people. This nephew of mine, Muhammad, cannot be compared with any other man. He has sought Khadija, daughter of Khuwaylib, for marriage. Then Waraqi stood up and said, "All praise is due to Allah, who has made us just as you have mentioned and preferred us over those whom you have indicated. For we, indeed, are the masters of Arabs and their leaders, and you all are worthy of this bond of marriage. The tribe, Quraysh, does not deny any of your merits, nor does anyone else dispute your lofty status and prestige. And we, furthermore, wish to be joined to your robe, so bear witness to my words. O people of Quraysh, I have given Khadija, daughter of Khuwaylid, in marriage to Muhammad ibn Abdullah." These passages are indeed proof of the fact that Khadija, peace upon her, and her family were staunch monotheist. That is the reason, the moment her husband told her of God's command to him to publicly proclaim his mission as the last and greatest prophet with the universal message of Islam, she immediately believed in him. Thereafter, she spent all her wealth to feed, clothe, and shelter the persecuted new Muslim community, to the extent that when she passed away, there was hardly anything left for her only surviving child, that is, daughter Fatimatu Zahra, peace upon her. Even though the First Lady of Islam passed away in Mecca before his historic migration to Medina, her memory was alive in the mind of the middle-aged prophet, who never considered the spouses he had taken in the last years of his life to be on a par with the beloved Khadija, peace upon her, whose memory he used to cherish. Once, when a certain wife felt jealous at the mention of Khadija's name and thought of herself as young and attractive, the prophet scolded her by saying, "By God, the Almighty did not grant me a better life than her. She believed in me when the people used to mock at me, and she acknowledged me when the people denied me. She shared her wealth and property with me, and she bore me children which I was not destined to have through other women." No wonder when 5 years later, Abu Talib's youngest child, son Imam Ali, peace upon him, was born. The Prophet and Khadija, peace upon them, who had lost their sons in infancy, took him under their care to nurture, raise, and eventually marry him to their infallible daughter, thus ensuring eternity for their blessed progeny. Could there be a better precedent set by the Prophet than his marriage to the most virtuous lady of her times, his respect for her during the quarter century of marital bliss, his cherishing of her memory till the end of his life as one of the four noblest ladies of all time, his profound affection for their daughter Fatima, peace upon her, son-in-law Imam Ali, peace upon him, and the grandsons Imam Hassan, peace upon him, and Imam Hussein, peace upon him, and his emphasis on her immaculate progeny, the Ahlul Bayt, as the evergreen tree of divine guidance for all mankind? In fact, so firm was the faith of First Lady of Islam that Archangel Gabriel conveyed to the Prophet a special message for her, saying, "O Messenger of Allah, when Khadija comes to you, greet her from Allah and give her the good tidings of a house made of precious stones in paradise."
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Midstream.
Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps has been adamant on demolishing since last week the headquarters of terrorist groups stationed in Iraqi Kurdistan after they tried to bring weapons to bordering Iranian cities and provoke riots inside the Islamic Republic of Iran. A statement by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps explained that these missile strikes, which began on September 24, were in retaliation to the military support by Kurdish groups to the Kurdish rioters inside Iran, who seek to destabilize security and stability on the eastern bank of the Iranian-Iraqi border. Deputy Commander-in-Chief of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps for Operations Affairs, Brigadier Abbas Nilfroshan, clarified that his country had informed the Kurdistan region of Iraq of its intention to respond to any party targeting Iran. In an interview with Al Alam News Channel, Brigadier General Nilfroshan indicated that the sites that were recently targeted in Kurdistan had a major role in the recent riots and chaos in Iran, adding that the riots that took place recently in the country were taken seriously by Iran and that Iran views its retaliation as legitimate self-defense. Iranian media reported that the Revolutionary Guards targeted headquarters belonging to the Komala Group, the Kurdish Democratic Group, and the PAK Group in Iraqi Kurdistan, following the arrival of armed insurgents and a large number of weapons to Iranian bordering cities to cause chaos and riots in the country. Iranian state television reported that 72 Revolutionary Guards missiles with a range of up to 130 kilometers were launched towards the territory of northern Iraq. Iran had already issued the necessary warnings to the authorities of the northern region of Iraq through relevant sources to dismantle the activities of anti-Iranian terrorist groups affiliated with what the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps statement called the global arrogance in the region. However, Kurdistan ignored this legitimate and legal demand related to the continued presence of terrorist groups on the border areas of the Islamic Republic of Iran, a presence which escalated into attacks on some Iranian bases and border checkpoints and most recently turned into logistical support for rioters inside Iran. This prompted legitimate self-defense from Iran, which obviously resulted in an American meltdown, especially after Washington declared the death of an American citizen as a result of the Iranian strikes. An American citizen in the headquarters of a Kurdish terrorist group targeting peace and security inside Iran. Are we surprised? I'm not. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The ground forces of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps stressed that the targeting of terrorist separatist groups in the Kurdistan region of Iraq came after these groups intervened in the recent riots inside Iran, and with the region of northern Iraq not heeding to the warnings to close their headquarters. The Iranian ground forces demanded in a statement the Iraqi central government and the regional government of northern Iraq to assume their responsibilities towards the Islamic Republic as their neighbor. Iran says the missiles and drones hit and destroyed most of the targets, stressing that the series of operations will continue until the terrorist group's weapons are disarmed. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mohammad Gharawi, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Mohammad. Now, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps continues its operations against terrorist organizations within the framework of what it called a new phase launched against these organizations that had threatened Iran's security and stability over the past couple of weeks. Are such operations enough to secure Iran's national security, or rather, might we see a further ground invasion initiated by Iran?
In the name of Allah, the most gracious, the most merciful, no doubt that the ongoing military operations for the past 8 days are operations targeting terrorist organizations that had in turn been targeting the national security of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Whether through their agents sent to destabilize Iran or through the logistical support and planning operations, I believe that these military operations will not advance further to become, as you mentioned, ground invasion by Iran towards Iraqi Kurdistan. I rather think that terrorist groups were dealt a severe blow in the past week after being targeted with precision missiles and bomber drones. Iran targeted the strategic depth of these terrorist groups to a point that the majority of their forces in their targeted area were dispersed. Add to that the continuous effort made by Iran's national security forces, who continue to pursue the retention of law and order inside the Islamic Republic, whether through the internal security forces or through Iran's intelligence services.
Well, Mr. Mohammed, the United States announced the killing of an American citizen in the Iranian bombings that targeted the armed groups in Iraq's Kurdistan. Now, U.S. State Department spokesman Vidant Patel declined to give further details, citing privacy laws. What is so private about an American citizen, probably a soldier on the border with Iran, aiding and helping and maybe abetting Kurdish separatists to threaten Iran's national security?
I think this American citizen who was supposedly killed as a result of the Iranian targeting of Kurdish separatist terrorist groups, I think he was responsible for creating a link between the Kurdish separatists and their American supporters. This is exactly what Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei mentioned yesterday by the statement he issued, saying that what was launched against Iran and what befell the Iranian national security following the tragic death of Miss Mahsa Amini are but an American-Israeli scheme. This dead American in Kurdistan is but one of many Americans who were sent to plan and execute that scheme, and was the linking connection between the terrorist groups, whether those residing in the western Iranian border with Iraq or in the eastern border of Iran. This means that many of those who were arrested by the Iranian security officers, who happened to be from different nationalities, more than 17 nationalities to be exact, took part in the terrorist activities inside Iran. This depicts that the foreign mastermind, and who is the US, some European states, and the Israelis in this case, are the ones directly running the regime change operations against Iran. This is not to forget the role of the foreign embassies inside Iran, who work day and night to ignite the streets of Iran with chaos and disruption.
Well, then do you think that such a statement by the U.S. State Department would actually put a calm on the rioters inside Iran, who now know that there is American support for wreaking havoc inside of Iran?
I don't think so, because the Americans are still adamant on Plan B, which they were preparing for Iran even before the riots, especially after the utter failure of the nuclear deal between Iran and the Biden administration. Thus, why I think that the U.S. will continue forward with its Plan B, the riots that Iran witnessed were but part of the big U.S. plan, so they might just increase the thrust of such actions like those we witnessed a couple of days back in Iran's Kurdistan and also in Zahedan. The U.S. might ignite other parts of Iran because the U.S. wants to see their Plan B fully implemented inside Iran.
Well, we did see that Iraq's Minister of Foreign Affairs disclosed on September 29th that Baghdad summoned the Iranian ambassador in protest of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps strikes in the Kurdistan region of Iraq. Now, the ministry rejected Iran's operation, saying those acts resulted in the intimidation of Iraqi citizens, calling on Tehran to respect Iraq's sovereignty and to abide by international law. Do you think that this incident will further maybe draw a rift between Iraq and Iran?
I don't believe that this incident will widen the drift between Iran and Iraq, if there were a drift to begin with. I believe that Iran was clear and concise in sending messages, the Iraqi government, through official visits and official letters sent to Iraqi government officials about the matter of Iraq's Kurdistan. Even in President Raisi's last visit to Iraq, he was adamant on mentioning this matter, stressing that Iraqis should savor their own security and the security of their neighbors. Hence, the Iraqi government should bear the responsibility of the actions of the separatist terrorist organizations against Iran. Because the Iraqi government did not preserve Iran's peace and security, Iran had to take matters into its own hands, because the Iraqi government failed to confine and disarm these terrorist organizations. Throughout the past years, Iran warned the Iraqi government multiple times about these groups who are targeting Iran's national security. But unfortunately, throughout these years, the Iraqi government did nothing to change this fact. That is why Iran found itself compelled to preserve peace and security of its own nation by confronting these terrorists vigorously, just as we saw them do over the past week.
Well, Aman, thank you very much, Mr. Mohammad Gharibi, political commentator from Beirut, for joining us to discuss this very important issue at the level of the regional geopolitics. Thank you for being with us. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about how Israel is completely stuck in the occupied West Bank.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Over the past years, the occupying power has focused its effort on getting the Palestinians to accept that their land is no longer theirs and to abandon their identity and their Palestinian cause in return for some periodic economic bids in the favor of some Palestinians. Now, indeed, this strategy has found people promoting and adopting it to the extent that it has become the best strategy for the political and military leaderships in the entity, depending on the extent of their right wing. What helped the Israeli entity in its endeavor to establish the equation of a deluxe occupation without any costs is that it was able to bend the Palestinian Authority and its security services in its favor and turn it into a proxy for Israel in suppressing any Palestinian aspiration to rebel against the occupation. Israel stuck in the West Bank in this following report.
Once again, Israel pushed the occupied West Bank into more tension, which would lead to a comprehensive explosion. The Zionist occupying power brought this upon itself by storming Jenin camp, leading to the fall of a number of martyrs and wounded. Yet another act of terrorism that will no doubt keep the Israeli occupation in the same vicious circle of attacks that lead to Palestinian retaliations and responses that entail more attacks and so on. This comes while up to 30 Israeli occupation battalions are spreading in the West Bank, working to besiege the Palestinians and dismember their areas in what looks like a circular noose that hardly excludes any town. Israel knows that the Palestinian incentives to launch operations against the occupation have reached its climax, and that the traditional measures, whether those carried out by Israel itself or taken over by the Palestinian Authority, are no longer producing the desired result. However, Israel is absurdly dealing with the manifestations of resistance against it in the West Bank as the root of the problem, when in reality, resistance is nothing but symptoms of the main root, which is the occupation itself. Over the past years, the Zionist occupation has focused its efforts on getting the Palestinians to accept that their land is no longer theirs and to abandon their identity and cause in return for periodic economic bids in their favor. What helped Israel in its endeavor is establishing the equation of a deluxe occupation without costs, meaning it was able to bend the Palestinian Authority and its security services to its favor and turn the Palestinian Authority into a proxy for Israel in suppressing any Palestinian aspiration to rebel against the equation. That the West Bank, after years of implementing that strategy, turns into a large military compound in which most of the Israeli army units and security services are imprisoned is the clearest evidence of the failure of previous Israeli policies. Also, it was proven that the strategy of dividing the occupied Palestinian arenas and pushing each of them to form its own identity did not depict the desired results, which was demonstrated by the Battle of the Sword of Al-Quds, where the interaction between the diverse battlefields of the West Bank, Al-Quds, Gaza, and the occupied interior was beautifully portrayed. What happened last week in Jenin camp is not measured by the number of martyrs and wounded in comparison to the Israeli human and non-human losses, but by its positioning in the course of the Palestinian cause as a whole. This is because the aggression itself and what may follow it, and the permanent advancement of the Palestinians to confront, as well as the continuous military siege that consumes the great capabilities of the Israeli army, is an expression of the reality of an occupation dilemma, with which Israel has lost all strategies except direct repression, which will only breed even more forms of resistance.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from the occupied West Bank is Dr. Saad Nimr, academic and political commentator. I want to thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Saad, to discuss this pressing issue in the occupied Palestinian West Bank. Now, the line of fire in the occupied West Bank has become clearer, extending from Jenin through Nablus to Al-Khalil, so that the clash remains thriving and the weapons are ready for any confrontation that may occur, similar to what happened last week in Jenin camp, which witnessed a new battle that may be the fiercest and the most prominent in the West Bank since years. How do you explain this new wave of very young resistance fighters, Palestinian resistance fighters, taking part in this act of resistance?
Yes, good evening. In reality, it's a kind of a reaction to what the Israeli are doing during the last period of time, where they're escalating all their atrocities against the Palestinians. And that gives us a good indication that the Palestinian factions generally, especially in the West Bank, are not acting, you know, on their own to resist the occupation in such way. And that meant then that they will have individual operations, individual events, people who are on their own having weapon and start resisting the occupation. That give us also the indication that this new generation, which they thought that they might not be interested, to the contrary, they are from one generation to another. We witness that Palestinians are insisting on resisting the occupation and start this resistance in a way that will lead to a huge uprising, we hope, and to copy the what happened in Jenin in so many different cities.
The latest confrontation of Jenin, Dr. Saad, proves that the Palestinian cause is still alive and very much well in the West Bank, and which was previously considered the Israelis' domesticated arena in comparison to other Palestinian arenas where Israel does not have control over. How do you think that the occupying entity of Israel will deal with the West Bank, knowing that the resistance will not be subdued, especially in Jenin?
Yes, we know that the Palestinians are going to resist, and they will continue to resist. Now, for the reaction of the Israeli forces, they were thinking of repeating the operation of occupying or reoccupying Jenin again, and especially the Jenin refugee camp, and they were threatening of doing so. But they know at the same time that the equation of which they used to have before is changing. Now, that will cost them a lot also to go into Jenin. There will be a huge casualties, and because of that, they are reluctant of doing this kind of attack to Jenin, but we are expecting anyway to do something like that. While in other cities, maybe it's less important, but Jenin, they want to break the issue of being an example and being a model, which is being copied in so many different areas and cities, which lead that the Palestinians are really still alive and they are still resisting this occupation to the end. And we believe that the occupation is going to escalate their atrocities against the Palestinians and everywhere in the West Bank, and unleashing their settlers as they do everywhere around. But apparently that the Palestinian resistance started to pick up the situation. I can tell you that yesterday, for instance, we were following the news. Yesterday alone, there was 12 incidents all over the West Bank of firing at the Israelis and the settlers in the West Bank, which is, a huge number. The Israeli report this morning was to talk about 213 operations last month of firing and attacking the Israeli troops and settlers. So we think that the resistance in the awake, and they are escalating bit by bit, and we hope that we will reach to the moment of a huge intifada against this occupation.
Dr. Saad, the aggression on Jenin camp came on the 22nd anniversary of the Al-Aqsa Intifada, as if the Israelis just wanted to remind the camp's residents of the massacres it had committed against them 22 years ago and against their families. However, the resistance fighters reminded the occupation, on the other hand, that of their own despair, of the Israeli despair in confronting the Palestinians. Where is the position of the Palestinian Authority from all of this?
Okay, this is an irony because, you know, 22 years ago when they have the incursion on the Palestinian refugee camp in Jenin and there was a resistance and 13 soldiers were killed and Israeli tasted what the Palestinian resistance means. Today, after 22 years, they are also trying to get back to refugee.